Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 3 of the Nature Friendly Farming Network podcast of this third series with me, Ben Eagle, and my favourite Welsh farming podcasting friend, Will Evans.
Your only Welsh podcasting friend, though.
Well, yeah, when I wrote that, I thought, that's probably true. But it's true. It's true nonetheless. Happy New Year to you. Happy New Year, Will, as well. Happy New Year from us, and welcome back to the show after a bit of a break over Christmas. We hope that you've had a good start to the year so far, and you'll know if you've listened to the first two episodes of this series. We're focusing in on NWFN's report and campaign called Rethink Farming in this series. Over to you, Will, to explain what we're talking about today and who's on the show.
Yeah, it's all about water today, something that we know a lot about in Wales, and I certainly do. A changing climate, as we're already seeing, will bring with it different rainfall patterns and greater extremes. And those managing the land and farming will be at the forefront of managing those changes, from storing and capturing water to adaptation. Our guest today is Sam Kenyon, who's based on a 160-acre farm in Denbighshire on the River Elwy. Sam keeps sheep and goats, turkeys for Christmas and hens for eggs. She's also about to start growing veg and has planted some fruit trees on the farm, and is also on the NWFN Wales steering group. She's travelled the world a couple of times and has even worked as a scuba dive guide. So she has spent plenty of time in the water and is therefore very well placed to be talking about today's subject. Sam, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. So we said a few things about the farm there, but can you tell us a bit about your part of the world, first of all?
Yeah, well, obviously it's beautiful because I'm in Wales. Hey, Will.
Obviously.
So we're in a steep-sided wooded valley. We are lowland. And yeah, it's just a very narrow valley, so the water hasn't got much space to go into when it's in flood. And we're just 9 miles from the coast, so we've got quite a big catchment area behind us with the Denbigh Moors.
So how did you originally get involved with NWFN, and what kind of work are you doing on the steering group? You know, what kind of things do you help members with?
So I got involved, I was a member, and then of the NFFN, and then they got in touch. They'd seen me on social media, I think. I like gobbing off a bit about farming with nature on Instagram. And then Hilary, who's the chair of the Wales group, she came and asked if I'd like to be on the steering group, which isn't something I ever thought I'd do. I never thought I'd be speaking with politicians and going to highbrow meetings. I'm still not today, but it's been really, can you edit that bit out?
This is a very highbrow meeting.
that's how I've got involved, through Hilary coming and finding me. And yeah, it's a massive step for me being brave enough to say yes. But it's also really helped because I don't feel quite so isolated in the way I'm farming.
That's really interesting, actually, because I think for a lot of us farmers, when we take that step into wider industry roles, it is a really big thing. And I've certainly had that sort of bit of imposter syndrome. It's something I often battle with, and I think a lot of farmers say the same. But I guess it's up to all of us if we want to make a difference to step up, isn't it? Which is what you've done.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's start talking about water. I mean, Sam, you've got plenty of floodplain on your land and you're on the banks of a river. What does this mean on a practical basis for you?
We don't have plenty of floodplain in that we're not a big farm. Like, the whole farm is just a field's width away from the river, sandwiched between the river and the steep-sided woodland. So that's part of the problem, in that the water hasn't got a vast area to flood. On a practical scale, we're sort of limited to farming to the limitations put in place by the winter weather patterns. So in summer, yeah, we're on a floodplain and the soil is fertile and things grow amazingly. And I get told by other farmers how lucky I am to be down here on this spot with the fertile soils. But then there's only so much I can really push the land to produce when in the winter it's underwater a few times and it's soggy all the time. It's not like I can get away with overstocking it at all.
Yeah. And what works are you doing on the riverbanks themselves?
So we've the farm was maize land mostly. So it was tenanted 5 years ago by a handful of different neighbours and most of it was growing maize. So we've taken it back in hand and we're putting permanent pasture down. And it's just shown that where there was the old pasture on some of the fields where it hadn't been ploughed up, it was the most resilient thing to the flooding. So the fields would flood and actually the level of the field would build up, whereas the fields that had the maize growing on them that would flood and you would lose the edge of the river, the edge of the field, and you'd also see the soil washing away. Yeah. So it was really like to have those two comparisons right in front of you, just staring you in the face. It just showed that the grass and the pasture acted like a sort of armor and helped to hold the nutrients that the river brings. And then the river banks themselves, the fences were really close up to the water's edge. So the vegetation was getting grazed quite close to the river. And then that meant there was no buffer when the flash floods come. So we've pulled back the field edges and we've moved the fences further in. We've scraped away the worst place. I want to do more of this, but it's just there. It all costs money. But we've scraped away the worst field that was affected so that the bank is like a 30 degree angle, rather, because it was just vertical, and then a wall of water would hit it, eat away underneath, and then the top of the field would fall in. And so we lost about 10 meters in 3 years of field edge. And so by scraping it away to this 30 degree angle, it's like we've given an area of the field for the water to fill, to breathe into, to sort of fill up into, rather than eating it away. And then what we did was we coppiced some willow trees from another field and then we literally buried them in the soil in that bank that we created. And they've acted as a massive root ball. Those willow trees have acted as a massive root ball and have shot up loads of willow, and there's so much other vegetation on that bank now. And it's just a much more resilient, practical habitat, I suppose.
That's really interesting. I mean, you've done a lot of work there. Have you had any help with it, or have any sort of organisations helped, or is it just something you've done yourself?
We haven't had financial help, except for two hedges. We've had part funding for two hedges that we've put in. But no, we haven't had any financial help. There is a responsibility if you're a riparian owner to keep the banks healthy, I suppose, for want of a better word. And I've just taken that and run with it and gone above and beyond just to save our farm and to keep the land where it's meant to be, which is not on the farm and not washing out to sea. Exactly. Or washing into the nearest town. But yeah. No, we haven't. I've started up a crowdfunding thing to try and get some more help to do a bigger project. But no, I haven't had any financial help otherwise.
Yeah. Well, tell us about that, because that's really interesting. You've started a crowdfunding project to create a flood basin, which will be rich in floodplain meadow species, and with an area of wet woodland to help hold flood water in winter. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I had this idea in my head. We've got this 24 acre field. It used to be 27 acres, but I forget, it shrinks every winter when we have the floods. It's the biggest field on the farm because we're only small. And our fields are quite small, so it's big for us. And it's the other side of the river, so I can't get to it in winter. So I figured it might as well earn its keep and be part of the solution to the flooding problems that we have. And because it's so big, if we sort of like increased its area or its capacity to hold water by digging down and creating a basin, we could hold like 2, 3, 4, 5 times as much water, which could then help the local community. So in my head, I had like the idea of making a massive watering hole, sort of like a big shallow basin like that. But doing the crowdfunding, that's not the kind of language that attracts funding support. So we're now sort of looking at maybe changing it slightly to creating a series of ponds, and then like the ponds will be that deep that we still can store the same amount of water as if it was one big shallow basin.
Really cool.
Yeah, that's amazing. So looking ahead into the future, how else are you predicting that you'll be managing water? What changes do you think you'll be seeing?
I'm not sure what the limitations will be in the future, if there'll be any, if maybe we'll come to realise what a precious resource our fresh water systems are. I don't know. I'd like to think, though, that perhaps I can't see how else we might be managing the water apart from what we're doing by creating loads of habitat and wanting to create a wet woodland area and the floodplain meadow basin pond area. But it would also be cool if we can manage the site in a way for education as well. So if we can perhaps do something with universities or with school children, just to show how land can not only be productive with growing healthy food, but if managed right, it can be used to help mitigate the effects of climate change and also stop the decline of biodiversity.
So cool. I mean, is that something that you have you done much of that anyway? Have you had sort of people out to farm or school groups, or is that something? I know that NWFN, a lot of members do that kind of thing. Is that something you're interested in doing more of?
I haven't had any school groups come out yet. I need to get certain access points and bathrooms and hand facilities in place, and apparently the river isn't enough for that. So we've got an old stone body that's not doing anything. It's not earning its keep at the moment, except for housing a couple of bats, I think. So it'd be awesome if we can extend on that and refurbish that as an outdoor classroom, just so we can welcome the next generation onto the place and show them the solutions that working with nature can give us.
Yeah, really cool. So what about on a wider basis with flooding and water, what are the main ways that farms are going to be impacted in terms of water management in the future? And what should farmers be thinking of doing now? Because you've obviously done this, you're thinking about now, you're thinking about the long-term future, but what should other farmers be thinking about doing to adapt to a changing climate?
I think we all need to look longer term than what we've had to. So sort of looking at land use and how it will affect the next generation and the generation after that. I think it's not uncommon now to experience dry spells as well. So perhaps thinking of a way that you can sort of factor in storing the rainwater that we get during these milder winters now. I don't know how we can piece it all together, but I know we're a hugely resourceful bunch. And I just think if we changed our mindset a bit to see how we can store the water to help us then with our crops as we go through the drier summers that we're seeing, or the warmer climate that we're seeing, I think that would be a step in the right direction. Mm-hmm. I think as an industry we've got a lot to offer. We just need to think along those resourceful lines and see. I think we're all experts in our own farms, aren't we? We all know how the land lies in our own farm. I can't go to somewhere else and tell them what they should be doing when they know which way the water drains better than me.
Yeah. So do you think that farmers, especially those in the uplands, and this sort of I always feel this is quite an easy thing for me to say as a lowland farmer, but the upland farmers, do you think they have a responsibility to hold on to water to protect those further downstream, you know, and especially those in urban areas?
I don't know if it's a responsibility. I think we can all do our bit across the whole landscape and the whole catchment area. Mm-hmm. I do smile when I see projects up in the uplands where they're restoring peat bogs, and where there's like planting trees on the hills and on the frieze. I don't know, as responsibility, I would call it a responsibility. Like, no one owes me any favors or a living, mm-hmm. but it would be really nice to have more of a catchment area or landscape scale frame of mind when it comes to sort of helping our communities. Because that, you know, they might be upland, we might be lowland, but we're all part of the farming community. So I just think it'd be a good thing to do. It'd certainly help a lot of us with our mental health.
Yes.
What about water quality? And this has been something that's been in the news recently in particular. It was mentioned in the report that in England and Wales, and this is the NWFN report here, only 14% and 46% of rivers respectively meet the standards for good ecological status. And in Northern Ireland, only 31% of water bodies are classified as good or high quality. Should we be doing more about this in the short term? And what are some of the things that we can do this on? I suppose in terms of just simple measures on our own farms, and in terms of changing mindset as well.
Short answer, definitely. Short term, I don't think better nutrient management planning would be a difficult place to start. It's like our river. I've touched on mental health before, and we are all a bit stressed in farming at the moment, not knowing what's happening with government policies. But one of the things I do to help is just going for a swim or going for a dip if there's enough water in there. And this summer, every time I went in, it smelled of slurry. So short term, definitely better nutrient management, I would say. Long term, I would really recommend planting up buffer zones on the water course, pulling back those fences so that our field edges are so far away from the water course. Replanting areas of wet woodland as well, just to help filter out pollutants. I mean, it's a system, isn't it? It's an ecosystem. There's a cycle. There's going to be bad stuff getting in there, but nature can deal with that if we give it the chance. But we're not giving it a chance if we're not replanting that up. So yeah, long term, I would go for buffer zones and wet woodland and just enhancing habitat and nature that's meant to be there.
So and clearly, farmers can be part of the solution to all of this, and we can all play our part. But who should be paying for this work to be done? Because you've just sort of talked about a lot of the work that you've done, and you can't, you know, you've got to make a living as well, even though you're someone who really cares about the environment and want to do your bit, as you mentioned, for future generations. But we can't do it all on our own. We're just not enough hours in the day. So who should be paying for this? Should government should be helping? Who do you think?
I think a mix of funding sources. So I do think government, and I also think corporate investors looking to offset. I think the water companies, I think they could help selling direct to customers and being able to charge that bit more gives us as a farmer more options as to, you know, making that living and investing back into the farmland. I think not just one place. I wouldn't just say it's down to government, because I don't want to see taxes going up. But I think a mix of funding sources would help. And again, it's that whole working together idea. That I think would help.
I guess that's why organisations like NWFN are so important, isn't it? Because they're the ones who can say to government or private organisations, as you said, look, there are all these farmers who are willing to help. We just need you to work with us. And I guess that's where they come in, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't think investing in nature and biodiversity and nature-based solutions is ever going to be a loss. No. Just because we don't see a return straight away, but you know, we'll see a return in before I think we'll see a return in like the next generation's lifetime, if not in ours. But I'm just being impatient. I want to see it in mine. I'm just cracking on.
Yeah. Okay then. So last question, and we're gonna ask all the guests this over the coming episodes and during this series, and it's up to you whatever way you want to interpret it, but what does rethink farming mean to you?
I think it's a wake-up call to shift the mindset that we're facing different struggles in society now. We're not a society that needs loads of food producing for it, because you know we've got like the health issues like obesity and diabetes, not to mention COVID. But I just think that there's still a bit of a mindset that it's all about production at whatever cost to nature, and that's just, well, we all know that's just not sustainable. You've only got to live on a river to know that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think a shift in mindset that we are so resourceful as a bunch of people. I don't think we always need to wait for policy to be made before we know what direction we can strike off in to make a positive difference. And I keep harping on about it, but the benefits to your mental health for just doing something positive for the land and for nature are just immense.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good point to leave it on. Yeah. That's all we've got time for today. But a massive thank you to you, Sam, for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. Thank you for listening. And please do spread the word and subscribe to the podcast. Next time, we'll be focused on biodiversity, the next part of the report, and we'll be heading up to Scotland. Happy New Year again, and we will see you next time.